Accession number 15736, Ernie Tompkins, reel 6.
Mr. Tompkins, reel 6. Now, before the end of the war, had you, you on your other tape, you described your mess life quite a lot. Now, before the end of the war, had that mess life started? I mean, what was mess life like at Bergue? Can't pronounce it.
At Berg.
What was mess life like there?
Oh, mess life?
During the war.
Yes. Well, it wasn't like nothing like the other place. We had huts for dinners and that, but they didn't celebrate the dinners quite so elaborately as they did when it got to Varsinair.
So what you talked about on the other tape that you recorded was about Varsinair, not about Berg.
No, that was Varsinair.
Well, what was it like? What would a typical mess night be like at Berg then, which you haven't done?
Well, it was all orderly, but not so elaborate, you know. I don't know whether... yes, I think the tables were set the same as the other place. We had quite a bit bigger hut, that's all, for the mess. But see, the point is, they were there doing a job. When we got to Varsinair, the job had been done, and you could celebrate and lead a normal life.
But what would it be like at Berg? I mean, do you remember what a mess night would be like?
No, there was nothing very special about it, because, as I say, it was only huts.
Did they drink much, or did you drink much at Berg?
As far as... I didn't drink a lot, but... I've explained. We used to get paid, of course, once a month, and we were expected to give the mess in funds £5. That's to supplement our ordinary mess and allowance from the government, you know. And then we used to get expected to take £5 worth of wine. So that was £10 a
month. That's
a month. That was quite a lot in those days, see.
Could you afford that?
Once a month we used to go into Dunkirk and celebrate. And that would cost us £5. Champagne. And really go to town on oysters and all sorts of things. That was a regular thing.
After the war had ended?
That was during the war as well.
What would one of those nights be like then?
But they were, at Varsinair, we didn't have any town to go to. I mean, we did it all in the mess. But
so what would the nights at Dunkirk be like?
The nights?
At Dunkirk, you know, the £5 nights. What would you do? What time would you set off there?
I'll tell you the truth, then. Of course, we used to play cards and that sort of thing, you know. Of course, we had a... the usual lounge and that sort of thing, spend the time there and have the drinks, but it wasn't so elaborate, as I said, as the other place.
Okay.
It'd be in huts, you couldn't see. There was no sort of background to it.
Now, did they drink a lot in your squadron or not? Because I know you feel that some accounts of drinking in the RAF are exaggerated. Was there much drinking?
There was one or two. There was probably did drink rather. There was a chap named Hawk there. Don't put this name down. He used to drink rather a lot. Biggest chap. Otherwise, I don't know if anybody used to. They might show signs of it, of having had, you know, a few too many. But you had to be careful, because you had to be on parade in the morning, and you had to feel fit. So it was up to you.
Would you sing songs in the mess? Because people often talk about Royal Flying.
Not a lot. Not. I can't remember a lot. They didn't do so much singing. Don't Fence Me In and that sort of thing, you know.
What about songs about the Royal Naval Air Service? Because were you very aware? Because you were the RAF, but you had been, it had been a Royal Naval Air Service squadron. Now, were you very aware of that naval attachment?
Well, no, I don't think. Because we didn't do much singing or anything. I can't remember doing a lot of singing. It wouldn't be a lot, but that's a part of the month or two before. I think we were so engrossed in what we were doing that the other life didn't seem to matter much, because after all you were on tenderhooks all the time, and you didn't feel like celebrating a lot.
But what I was asking was whether you felt the RAF had been formed on the 1st of April. And two, it had been number 2 Squadron Royal Naval Air Service. Now it was 202 Squadron RAF. Now, were you very aware of your former links with the Royal Naval Air Service? I mean, did you feel that you were still part of the Royal Naval Air Service? Or were you...
Very much so. I mean, they were still the Royal Naval Air Service. Like, names didn't matter. They never did really like being part of the RAF. And they're now, like as you said, they're the Fleet Air Arm, look.
And you felt all, like that then?
I mean, you saw that. I showed you, I had an invite to Yeovilton, rededication of church. This is the from the flag officer, Naval Aviation.
But how did you feel then, in 1918, about the RAF?
Well, I will tell you this. When, so I heard, I wasn't there then, the 1st of April, when 202 Squadron became... when number 2 Squadron became 202 Squadron, it didn't go down very well with those people. They thought they were being degraded a bit. But they didn't like having to join up with the Royal Flying Corps.
How did you feel about the Royal Flying Corps yourself?
Well, I like the Royal Flying Corps. I don't know why I was interested in RNS at all, but... I like the Royal Flying Corps.
So you weren't, but wouldn't you weren't so bothered.
Wouldn't have mattered to me if I'd still been Royal Flying Corps. But.
What about, did the number 202 Squadron still have many naval traditions in 1918, in November and the rest of the year? I mean, were there still naval language?
Yes, they still, right. They still do, I expect. I think they still
can
do.
You give some examples on tape of the way they talked? I mean, wardroom, that was one. Were there any others? Because that's completely naval.
That's, no. Well, of course, you're always port and starboard. You know, you no right and left. It's always port and starboard. I can't remember any particular Navy expressions they used to use.
Were some of them still wearing RNAS uniforms, or were
they were still wearing it.
What uniform did you have?
I had you raised the point. When I was commissioned, there was no blue uniform. Matter of fact, I understood they got some cloth from Russia to make blue uniforms, but there was no blue uniform. I had to have a khaki. So the uniform, you'll see I'm wearing it there. I stood up against a tree there. It was just an ordinary khaki, well, more or less army uniform look. You wouldn't tell much difference.
And what were the rest of them wearing in 202 Squadron?
Well, they would be the blue. We're all wearing the blue look. And so I didn't have the blue, see.
Did you ever get a different uniform?
No.
So you stayed in khaki to the end?
Right to the end. Yeah.
Well, one thing I just want to pick up, did you have any casualties in your squadron while you were with them, before the war ended?
I can't remember one. If they did, I wouldn't know anything about it. I'm just trying to think whether any machines or ours was missing or not.
Now, you moved on the 14th of November, 1918... to Vasegnes, to your next base, I think. Could you just say how you used to pronounce it? Your next base after Bergs. Berg.
Yeah, Barcenaire.
Barcenaire, that's it.
That's it.
Now, you moved there on the 14th of November. What was that base like then? Could you describe that?
Yes, I can describe it very well. If you notice, my passenger was an Akema. You see it?
Yes, air mechanic.
An air mechanic. Now, Varsenaire, I understand, was where Rick Tobin was at one time. That's what the locals told us, anyway. And if you notice, there's a photograph of the farmhouse that we had from Mess. Have you seen that one?
I have, yes.
Well, on the end, you will see a little dark extension. Well, I told you about bios. That was only alteration. The ground floor was that's where all the work was done. But all the top floor was the mess, and that on the side it was the ante room there. You had to have an ante room, see. They used to call ante room, and all the cooking and that was done underneath. And that was a farmhouse. And as I say, you got the photograph there.
Now, do you want to describe for us what mess life was like there, or would you rather not?
Describe what?
What mess life was like there? Because I know you've done this before on the other tape we have. Do you want to describe it or not?
The mess life was very orderly. Very orderly. We had two long tables, one across the top. Don't forget, we got about 40 men at least. And on the top would be the major and the flight captains each side, plus perhaps the padre, if the padre happened to be there. And we'd have the four lines each side the tables. And as I say, it was very orderly. The waitress, they were properly trained. You know, they would come and hold down, and you would help yourself for whatever it was, you know. If, and this was a regular thing, we had to spend £5 a month on wines. If you thought you could manage it, you'd light a cigarette up before the major lit his pipe. If you did that, there'd be a tap on the table. Lieutenant Tompkins will stand around and drinks. And that would cost you, a whiskey was 4 pence. Threepence for about a pint of beer. Whiskey was 4 pence. And there was 240 pence a pound, so you can tell the difference in values in those days. That's how you spent your money. If you wanted a tea, we used to go to the farmhouse and buy eggs and that sort of thing. Tea wasn't a normal menu, you know, meal. So if you wanted a bit of tea yourself, you go and get some eggs and they would buy these eggs for you, or might be able to get some toast or something. You could have a snack if you wanted it, but you have to pay for it. You'd have to pay for the eggs and all that sort of thing. I don't think the cook-house man is getting, mind you, having a cup of tea. That wasn't a regular meal. That was a bit of an extra. I never forget, we went to a farmhouse to get some eggs, and the chap I was with had an argument with the farmer about the price, you see. He reckoned he should have had he put his eggs out, and the farmer charged him, see, what he thought was a little bit too much, one egg too much, and he picks up the egg. Oh, what if he sort of say dropped it? Of course, he broke the egg. Accident. He dropped it purposely. A farmer was doing him out of an egg. Oh, sorry about that. You know, dropped the egg.
Was there more drinking after the war, would you say, than during the war?
Well, I'd say there was slightly, but the drinking wasn't so bad that people went rolling around, you know. I mean, you'd there was still orderly life. I wouldn't say the drinking was, well, they wouldn't have to drink too much or else they'd soon get pulled up, but there was one or two that near the border, you know.
Would they have mess games at all? These games of climbing round things and different types of rugby and things. Did they have that?
Mess what?
Games.
Games?
Rough games, usually.
No, we used to play cards, of course, see, but... yes. Never forget. The officers played the NCOs at football. I think I put this down somewhere. And the football field was next door to the railway. And the railway was next to the road. They used to do that. And long lines of trees, straight, you know. And one of the drivers put his tender or truck on the railway. He just swerved off the road onto the railway, see. They didn't see many trains there. Of course, it had to be, but a train did come along. And there was a lot of blowing and puffing and all that sort of business, you know. And they leaned out, and all the Akemas was quite close on the touchline. And there's driver and pilot was all waving, see. And one of them said, well, I'll tell you what he said. You'll get it from this. A man was driving his sheep along the road and a motor car came along. See? No response from the farmer. He's still driving his sheep. And this man had his wife next to him, see? So this farmer turned around and shouted back. So the woman said to her husband, she said, what a silly man. He said, we can see their sheep. What's he mean, bullocks? We can see their sheep. And that's what was shouted out at that place, you know. And the passenger all shouted back. They didn't know any English, but they could shout that back, see. You used to have a bit of fun now and again.
What about your actual flying? I see you were still flying DH-4s, of course. Mainly, yeah. It seems to have been formation practice and one engine.
Ah, that's test. Only because we weren't supposed to use any petrol. That's a blind.
So what were you doing?
Well, the government put the bar up to use a lot of petrol after the war. They had tried to balance the budget. And we had to have a reason for flying, and that's what they put it, formation practice.
So what would you be doing when you were flying?
Normally just flying around, you know, perhaps visiting places. We didn't have to make a lot of show about it on the notes there.
Now, you were going to tell me this story about Prince or King Albert. That
yes.
was in January. I don't know whether anything else you...
I'll tell you about that. And he said, that should be yours, Tom. And he said, open it. I opened it.
Who said this? Hang on, we haven't understood.
This is Bladen. Lieutenant Bladen. And then it said, in memory of our flight to Antwerp, Albert. And he said to me, he said, now this hadn't been mentioned. This is about a fortnight afterwards. I was going to take him up myself, you see.
King Albert.
And he said, that should have been yours, Tom. How come? Well, he said, I took over from you. I didn't know who it was took over from me, because the CO, I was revving up, warming up, you know, and the CO came and he went like this. He said, just like that.
A gesture, so, to get out.
That's right. I got out, and all the other people were on the other side of the aeroplane. I got out and walked away. I started to glance back. There was a crowd there. And I didn't know that Bladen was the man that was took him. What happened? Well, I didn't know what I had to do at that time, see. I didn't know I was supposed to take the King of the Belgium. And I said, well, I'll come then. He said, well, you know you were warming up, going to do a job. And I said, yeah. Well, he said, that's what it was. Take King of the Belgians over to Antwerp. He said, you lost that. He said, I happened to be around, and Major Ghost saw me, and he was senior to me, see, Bladen. But in any case, I was the what they call the duty officer for the day. That's why he come to get on me. Look, he rang up and said, would I get prepared? I was duty officer.
Now, we just had a break, and there's two more topics come up from the war that I'd like to ask you. When you weren't flying, this is during the war, when you weren't flying, what would you be doing?
Generally playing cards. We might go into you could be going into Dunkirk. That was a usual thing, perhaps going to Dunkirk, see, that's only a couple of miles away, 2 or 3 miles away. So that's about the only place we would visit.
Did you have any other duties, though?
Duties? Of course, we used to have a regular, what is it called, duty officer.
What would they do? This is during the war.
Well, it's only sort of a lackey for the CO. I don't know in particular duties you had to do, but...
So you, the days were pretty well much your own during the war. You could do what you want. If you weren't actually flying, you could pretty well do what you wanted.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, it wasn't like being in this country, you get lectures and that sort of thing. We had nothing like that, look.
That's one point. And the other point is, did you ever take bombs with you?
No. No, we never took bombs. The only bombs that we may have taken would be a 20-pound Cooper. That was the usual ones, 20-pound Coopers.
Did you have? But you don't remember using them. That,
but we didn't carry them ourselves. I'm not sure whether Number One Squadron were flying camels. Whether they took a couple of bombs as well, I don't know. But there wouldn't be much weight, see.
And the other thing is, were you or any of the others superstitious? Would you have any superstitious routines or things you take with you?
No, I don't think I did.
You had no lucky mascot?
Yeah, they used to have mascots on the airplane, see, very often. You'll see that one of mine, there was all sorts of things.
What was yours?
That one I was talking about is, I think it's two men doing this, you know.
That's a drawing of two men thumbing their noses at each other.
That's right.
And who chose that?
I don't know, it was there when I had it. They used to be perhaps more like that before I went there, like a joke.
Okay, that was just now back in. Was there anything else you remember before your last flight home? Because you flew back on the 6th of March 1919.
That's it.
And DH4 6988, I think, a 90-minute flight. Now, could you tell me about that flight? Because although you've that's not on tape, what happened?
Oh, that, as I say, this is on that memoirs I got.
There's a 4-page document in your file with it on, yes.
That's
if you
right.
Can tell us the story.
Well, as you say, it was the 6th of March. It had been very wet all day. And after tea, the major rang me up. He said, would you take a machine over to Dover with two others? And that was one from each flight, apparently, the three of us. See? So I don't know who it was at the time, that was flying with me, because they went to the respective hangars and got the machines out, same as I did, and climb in. And of course, with the helmet and all on, you can't see who it is. And we went on the aerodrome, lined up, as we usually did, in formation for takeoff, see, in threes. Now, as I say, it had been wet all day, but it cleared up. But there was low clouds. Now, you might, if you're ready, you wonder why we flew at 9,000 feet. They think, well, that's rather crazy to get up to 9,000 feet. But it's not. We did climb up to 9,000 feet. When we turned across the channel, I saw the pale blue exhaust flames of these other two eagles belching out. And as it happens, I was leading the formation, see. And I saw these other two eagles belching out there. And I thought, gosh, it got dark then. Very dark. And of course, we didn't have navigation lights, though. So I went like that, see?
You made the symbol for going down.
That's right, going down. So I did. And I broke through at around about 2,000 feet. Now, the idea of going 9,000 feet was this. As they picked the wrong thing, actually. If you're up at 9,000 feet and your engine failed, which very often happened, in the middle, you had a good chance of reaching the shore either one way or the other. You'd have to be right slap bang in the middle perhaps to not be able to do that, but we could reckon to get a mile per 1,000 feet to glide, not a mile per 1,000 feet. Well, I expect they thought that it's a bit risky going down through, see, because we only just started across the channel. And when I broke through, as I said, I saw lights ahead and lights to the starboard, see. Still no sign of the others. Well, I dismissed them from my mind altogether. And I followed the lights until the old massive lights. I knew I was over Dover. As I said, I got this done. And I made for, they told me that the drone was at Westcliff. That's all I knew. Westcliff. So I made for Westcliff. And I was then, come pretty low, see, looking for some flares. But I couldn't find any flares. There was no flares about. So I got down very low and circled round and saw a clear place, as I thought. No trees or houses. So I did my drill, as I said. Now, my drill was to use up the petrol in the system. I'm going to land all of a sudden. I don't know what I'm going to meet. I certainly don't want to get burnt to death. You can be perfectly fit, sat in your machine, not be able to get out, but otherwise intact, and perhaps get burnt to death, so you get out of the fire. So I made for this open space, and I felt the wheels touch down and went, well, I thought about 50 yards or so, and a man came running over and he said, are you all right, sir? I said, yes, I'm all right. He said, you were lucky. Now, I didn't put this in my memoirs, but this is what I did say. I said, look. I said, you call that luck? The plane was up on its nose, see? I said, first of all, I landed the plane like that. He said, you were lucky. He said, I was on the road when this big thing plowed through the two hedges just in front of me. Well, those two hedges might have saved my life because they pulled me up. You see, there was a good thing happened. So they I had to find, fortunately I had this chap with me, and I said, well, where's the nearest phone? He told me. I said, well, I got no English money at all. So he lent me out two or three coppers, you know, and I rang up the aerodrome.